From Pacifica Network, broadcasting from Los Angeles, this is Democracy Now!
I am Mordechai Vanunu, the man behind the Sunday Times article from October 5th, 1986, the article about Israel nuclear weapons.
Mordechai Vanunu, the man who blew the whistle on Israel's nuclear program, is freed from prison after 18 years. But is he free? We'll go to Ashkelon, Israel, and speak with his adoptive parents. More than 90 Iraqis are killed in bombings in Basra and Abu Ghraib prison outside Baghdad as the battle for Fallujah intensifies, and there's an explosion in Saudi Arabia. And the U.S. government defends its Guantanamo prison camps before the Supreme Court.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the United States is at war.
The government argument was punctured when Justice Stevens asked, wouldn't you have the right to hold these people whether there was a war or not?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting live from Los Angeles. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 68 Iraqis have died and about 200 have been wounded after a series of three near simultaneous bombings outside three police stations this morning in the southern Iraqi city of Basra. Among the dead include 20 Iraqi school children who were traveling near the blasts and school buses. Until now, the Shiite city of Basra has been one of the most peaceful and quiet cities in Iraq. The bombings mark the worst attacks in Basra since the U.S. occupation began. There were reports that when the British troops arrived at the scene of the bombings, they were attacked with stones. The three police stations were hit within minutes of each other around 7:15 in the morning local time. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, 22 Iraqis died. Another 92 were injured when the Abu Ghraib prison came under mortar attack. In Fallujah, heavy fighting between the U.S. and the resistance began again this morning. U.S. gunships patrolled the skies. Both sides exchanged mortar fire. The U.S. began conducting door-to-door searches. U.S. officials say they killed at least 9 Iraqis. At least 700 Iraqis have died in Fallujah this month. In Washington, Senator Chuck Hagel said the worsening situation in Iraq may force the United States to reintroduce the military draft. During a hearing of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Hagel said, quote, there's not an American that does not understand what we are engaged in today and what the prospects are for the future. Why shouldn't we ask all our citizens to bear some responsibility and pay some price, he asked. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld announced Tuesday the Pentagon has drafted plans so it can quickly send more troops to Iraq if they're requested by General John Abizaid. 135,000 U.S. troops are already stationed in Iraq. But according to the New York Times, any new forces will have to come from the National Guard reserves because the U.S. has no more active duty troops available. The U.S.-led coalition was dealt another setback Tuesday when the Dominican Republic announced it will join Spain and Honduras in pulling its troops out of Iraq. The Los Angeles Times reports Secretary of State General Colin Powell made personal calls to almost all of the members of the U.S.-led so-called coalition to assess their commitment to staying in Iraq. Meanwhile, former National Security Advisor Sandy Berger told the Senate Tuesday the U.S. will likely have to maintain a high troop level in Iraq for up to 5 years and spend another $200 billion over the next 3 years to stabilize Iraq. And the nephew of Iraqi National Congress leader Ahmed Chalabi has been selected to head a tribunal of Iraqi judges and prosecutors to try Saddam Hussein. In other Iraq news, ABC News is reporting three senior United Nations officials are suspected of taking multi-million-dollar bribes from the Saddam Hussein regime through the Oil for Food program. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has announced there will be a full investigation. And reports from the Saudi capital say there are a series of loud explosions in Riyadh. The explosions came from the vicinity of the General Security Building, which is affiliated with the Interior Ministry. A police official confirmed the explosions to the Associated Press, but did not provide details about the cause or whether there were any casualties. Witnesses said the explosions, which occurred around 2 p.m. local time, shattered windows and damaged walls in surrounding buildings. Security forces evacuated the area. The explosions came only days after Saudi authorities announced they had seized three booby-trapped SUVs that were loaded with more than 4 tons of explosives and had apparently been abandoned by militants involved in a shootout with security forces. The United States last week ordered the departure of non-essential U.S. government employees and family members from Saudi Arabia. It also urged private citizens to leave the kingdom, and the U.S. Embassy in Riyadh issued an advisory warning of credible indications, quote, of terrorist threats aimed at American and Western interests in Saudi Arabia, unquote. And this news from Israel. Nuclear whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu was released earlier today from prison 18 years after he leaked detailed information about Israel's secret nuclear weapons program. He told reporters he had no regrets and that he'd been held in cruel and barbaric conditions. We'll hear from his news conference in just a few minutes. In other news from Israel, early this morning, 25 Israeli tanks backed by Israeli helicopter gunships invaded the town of Beit Laia in northern Gaza. 9 Palestinians have been killed there over the last day. In Turkey, a court has ruled that Kurdish rights activist Leyla Zana and 3 other leading Kurds must remain in prison, even though the European Court of Human Rights determined last year that their original trial was unfair. The top editor at USA Today, Karen Jurgensen, has resigned a month after the paper revealed its one-time star reporter, Jack Kelly, made up numerous stories. On Tuesday night, Vice President Dick Cheney hailed the anti-abortion movement as a, quote, great movement of conscience at an annual awards dinner for the National Right to Life Committee. Cheney went on to say, quote, President Bush has often expressed his conviction that in a compassionate society, every child must be welcomed in life and protected in law. America still has some distance to travel before that hope is realized, Cheney said. His speech came 5 days before a coalition of women's groups are staging what is expected to be the largest women's rights march in Washington in over a decade. Groups are estimating hundreds of thousands of people will take part in the March for Women's Lives on Sunday. Organizers include NOW and NARAL, Pro-Choice American, as well as Planned Parenthood. Pacifica Radio will be broadcasting the march live. And in Washington today, protesters are planning to rally outside the World Bank and the IMF to mark the 60th birthday of the institutions. Activists plan to deliver thousands of birthday cards signed by people across the country calling for full debt cancellation to impoverished countries.
Family, the animal family.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We are broadcasting from Los Angeles in our Exception to the Rulers tour as we go through 70 cities. I'm Amy Goodman. Nuclear whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu was released from prison this morning in Israel after serving 18 years for revealing to the world that the country has a nuclear arsenal. For more than 11 of those 18 years, Mordechai Vanunu was kept in solitary confinement. He walked out of the Shikhama prison in the coastal town of Ashkelon, flashing a peace sign and waved to cheering supporters. At an impromptu press conference, Vanunu said he was proud of what he did and described what he called, quote, very cruel and barbaric treatment at the hands of Israeli intelligence and the military. Vanunu said Israel's Mossad spy agency and the Shin Bet security services tried to rob him of his sanity by keeping him in solitary confinement for nearly 12 years. He said his message to these forces was, quote, you didn't succeed to break me. You didn't succeed to make me crazy. He said his case is proof that, quote, you cannot break the human spirit. Now that he has been released from prison, Vanunu faces what his supporters call draconian restrictions placed on him by the Israeli government. The restrictions derive from emergency rules inherited by Israel from the 1940s British mandate over Palestine. Among them, Vanunu will have to register to live in an Israeli city of his choice. He will have to give notice to the authorities if he wishes to travel to another city. He will not be allowed to leave Israel for 6 months, a rule that could be extended indefinitely. Vanunu is forbidden to contact foreigners either by phone or in person, and he will not be allowed to go within 100 meters of any embassy, visit any port of entry, come within 300 meters of any international boundary, and he may not be allowed to worship in a church of his choice. Here is some of what Mordechai Vanunu said today, right after he walked out of prison.
I am Mordechai Vanunu, the man behind the Sunday Times article from October 5th, 1986, the article about Israel nuclear weapons. I was kidnapped in Rome, Italy, by Israel's spy. In September 13th, and I was brought to Israel, arrived to Ashkelon prison on October 7th. I was here, I am here in the prison, in this prison, Ashkelon prison, from October 7th, 1986 until today, 17 and a half years, in very cruel, barbaric treatment by Israel, spy Mossad Shabak. This prison is guided and controlled by Shabak Mossad. I am proud and happy to do what I did. I am very glad that I succeeded to do what I did.
How are you going to keep the restrictions,
Vanunu?
How
are you going to keep
the restrictions? Any secrets, all this bullshit, blah, 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 about secrets is dead. My case is dead. The article was published. There is no more any secret. All the secrets was published in the hand of all the world. All the world, every state, 180 states received these secrets. I am now ready to start my life.
Mordechai Vanunu holding his news conference as he walked out of prison today after 18 years. He worked as a nuclear technician at Dimona, Israel's secret nuclear installation from 1976 to 1985. Mordechai Vanunu worked there at a time when Israel was insisting it would not be the first to introduce nuclear weapons into the Middle East. What Vanunu discovered is that Israel was developing an extensive nuclear program, hiding its existence from the Israeli people, the parliament, and the world. The Dimona facility, where Vanunu worked, harbored an underground plutonium separation plant operated in strictest secrecy. As the years went by, Vanunu grew increasingly troubled as he realized his work was part of Israel's nuclear bomb program. In 1985, before leaving Dimona, he took extensive photographs inside the factory. Traveling through Asia with the film in his backpack, Vanunu made his way to Sydney, Australia, where he converted to Christianity, joined an Anglican church and social justice community, where he shared the story of his nuclear background. The London Sunday Times learned of his story and sent a reporter to Sydney. The newspaper then flew Vanunu to England, where his photos and facts were further checked by British scientists familiar with nuclear weapons. Vanunu's story, published on October 5, 1986, gave the world its first authoritative confirmation that Israel had become a major nuclear weapons power, with material for as many as 200 nuclear warheads of advanced design. But days before the story was published, on September 30, 1986, Vanunu was lured to Rome by a female Mossad agent, where he was kidnapped, drugged, and put on an Israeli cargo vessel. In Israel, he was charged with treason and espionage. His trial was conducted in total secrecy, and he was sentenced to 18 years in prison. As he walked out of the prison in Ashkelon, Israel, today, he was met by his adoptive parents, Nick and Mary Eloff. Mary Eloff joins us on the phone from Ashkelon. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, we're thrilled to listen to your program.
Well, can you tell us, can you describe the scene when Mordechai Vanunu walked out of prison, your adoptive son?
The scene was at once joyous and at once hideous, because there were many, many, many Jewish hecklers there that were screaming and taunting and, you know, saying vicious, vicious things to him. They were next to the prison gate, and we, with all the supporters of Mordechai, were behind the fence. We had to stay behind the fence. And we were, a man was blowing a trumpet, and people were singing peace, salam, shalom, and I love you, Mordechai. So, you know, there was a lot of good noise coming across, but right in front of the prison were the hecklers.
Mm-hmm. And can you describe who the supporters were? Who the supporters are in Ashkelon?
Yes, there were supporters from at least 10 countries, Japan, Germany, England, Australia, New Zealand, Denmark, Holland, the United States, of course, were there in great numbers. And the two campaigns did a wonderful job of, you know, bringing people to Ashkelon, busloads. And people came from Jerusalem in buses. It came from Nazareth in buses. It was just a glorious, glorious day.
And where is Mordechai Vanunu right now?
He's in Jerusalem. Bishop Ria Abu Sal has given him sanctuary.
And who is he?
He's the Anglican Bishop of Jerusalem. Meir really felt, his brother really felt, that he was not secure. Israel leaked the address of the place where he was going to live. It was in the front page of the newspapers yesterday. Can you imagine that they, with the atmosphere in this country, that they would reveal the address of the place where he was going to live? So Meir felt that he just couldn't possibly go there. So he asked Bishop Ryan, and Bishop Ria agreed to give him sanctuary.
Mary Eloff, how did you come to be Mordechai Vanunu's adoptive mother?
Sam Day was the coordinator of the U.S. campaign to free Mordechai, and he had written an article in the Progressive magazine published in Madison, Wisconsin, and I read the horrible story, and I thought, couldn't be, had to be, you know, the dark ages, because 6 by 9 foot windowless cell, even when he exercised, there was a plastic barrier around him. And then I thought, what, you know, heinous crime did he commit, and discovered that he was a hero, that he had revealed that Israel, you know, had the nuclear reactor at Dimona. And so at the end of the article, Sam said, you know, you could write to him, and we began a correspondence in 95. And then out of frustration, because the political process wasn't working, all the thousands of petitions that went to President Clinton were never answered, Nick and I just thought, well, we'll adopt him and bring him to the United States, even if he has to be in prison. That's a way to get him out of Israel.
And then what happened?
Well, what happened was that he went to parole hearing after parole hearing, in which they said he still had secrets. Mordecai was only a technician, wasn't a scientist, so everything that he could reveal, the secrets that he had, were the photos. But they couldn't let go if they wanted to break him.
We're also joined on the telephone by Felice Cohen-Joppa, coordinator of the U.S. campaign to free Mordechai Vanunu. You two were in Ashkelon?
That's right, Amy. I was there today and actually was near the gate when Mordechai was released and was able to see in where they did allow a huge number of press people in for this conference and watched Mordechai give his press conference. And then he was allowed to come up to the edge of the gate, and he flashed peace signs to the crowd on the outside. When he got in his car later on with his brothers and his nephew and drove out, he pressed his palm against the glass, which is, of course, how in 1986 he let the world know that he was kidnapped from Rome by writing a message on his palm on the way to court in the back of a police van. It was really very moving.
That is the most famous picture of Mordechai Vanunu putting up his hand like that at the back of the police van. Can you tell us what it said at the time?
It just gave the information. It said kidnapped, and it gave the flight number from Rome, from London to Rome, which when he was lured by Cindy, this Mossad agent, and they flew together to Rome, so that no one knew for a month where or what had happened to him. His family thought that perhaps he had been killed because they knew that he was taking this risk. So that was the first inkling, really, that we had, that he had, in fact, been in custody in Israel for that month.
I'd like to ask you both to stay on the line for 1 minute as we take our break. We're talking to Felice Cohen-Joppa, coordinator of the U.S. campaign to free Mordechai Vanunu, and Mary Elof, who is the adoptive mother of Mordechai Vanunu, who has just been released from prison after 18 years. This is Democracy Now! And democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now! And democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we broadcast over more than 220 radio and television stations around the United States, as well as radio stations across Australia and Canada, broadcasting video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. We are traveling around the country in an Exception to the Ruler's book and media tour celebrating independent media. Tonight, we will be in Los Angeles at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church at 3300 Wilshire Boulevard at Barrendo. Looking forward to seeing listeners of KPFK celebrating the second Pacifica station. As we continue now on Mordechai Vanunu for just a minute, and then we'll talk about the latest in Iraq. Mary Elof, your closing thoughts. Mary Elof, adoptive mother of Mordechai Vanunu, released today after 18 years in prison. What are his plans?
He would like to lead a quiet life. We saw him on Monday morning, and he said, you know, I'd really like to get married and just to be part of society as an average person able to walk down the street. On Monday, he was really in the depths. He said, my heart is broken, because he thought freedom would mean that he would walk out and be free like the rest of us walking around here in Ashkelon. So I pray that this restriction for him is shortened. Our attorneys are working on that. It'll go to the Supreme Court.
But I would really ask his supporters around the world to continue to send him energy and prayers and thoughts, because I'm convinced that book's given him strength. And I would like to personally thank all of those who are with him today.
Felice Cohen-Joppa, the restrictions now are?
The restrictions now, as we hear, some of them are being lifted, such as we believe that now he'll be able to meet with foreigners, so the international delegation will be able to meet with him. But, Amy, it's really important, I think, for us to realize that Israel, by imposing these restrictions, are building a special prison just for this one man, and it's an outrage and an injustice that's not befitting for a democratic nation. And we need to continue to do what Mordechai, you know, began and gave so many years of his life for, and that is continue the struggle for the abolition of nuclear weapons, not only in the Middle East, but of course the United States has more nuclear weapons than any other country. We need to abolish nuclear weapons around the world. And for those of you who are in New York or Washington, D.C., listening in Boston, there are vigils all over the world, including in U.S. cities, in New York. If you go to www.venunu.com, you can find out more information there.
I want to thank you, Felice Cohen-Joppa, as well as Mary Eloff, today on the day that Mordechai Vanunu, the Dimona technician, has been released from prison after 18 years for spilling the secrets of Israel's nuclear weapons program. This is Democracy Now! As we move to the story of the latest bombings across Iraq, a major spate of bombings has rocked cities across Iraq today. Death tolls continue to rise. The southern city of Basra, three car bombs explode in front of Iraqi police stations, killing up to 68 people, wounding more than 230. The BBC is reporting that two school buses were hit in the blast, many of the casualties Iraqi school children. Meanwhile, there was a major mortar attack at the Abu Ghraib prison outside of Baghdad. There are reports that more than 22 Iraqis were killed, while more than 90 were injured. And just west of the Iraqi capital, the battle for Fallujah has escalated significantly over the past 24 hours. Dozens of Iraqi resistance fighters attack U.S. troops with guns and grenades, mounting a massive barrage of rocket-propelled grenades and small arms fire. An unconfirmed report said six civilians were killed in the fighting. This comes as Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld warned that talks with locals might not produce a peaceful outcome in Fallujah. And the reports now in Saudi Arabia, in Riyadh, blasts close to a security forces building in an area housing government offices have shattered windows and damaged masonry. Police have repeatedly clashed with Islamic militants around Riyadh for the last 2 weeks and have intercepted, they say, five vehicles packed with explosives. The suspected attack happened near the general security building in central Riyadh's Nasiriya district, according to witnesses. Last week, the U.S. ordered all non-essential diplomatic staff to leave Riyadh. Crown Prince Abdullah said at last Monday's cabinet meeting terrorism would be confronted and every citizen is now a member of the security forces. The BBC Middle East correspondent says the Saudi royals seem now to have realized they're in a fight for their very survival as rulers of the state which carry their name. We turn now to Asad Abu Khalil, who is a professor of political science at California State University Stanislaus and a visiting professor now at UC Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you talk about the latest explosions from Iraq to Saudi Arabia?
Well, it's hard to begin because it seems that violence and terrorism are sweeping throughout the Middle East. And one of the most astounding aspect of the debate about September 11 is that you have congressional committees talking about what the administration did or did not do regarding preparation for September 11, and I don't understand why there is no debate in the American media and Congress about what this administration has done to exacerbate and compound the problem of terrorism. If you look at the record of what is going on in many of the client dictatorships of the United States throughout the region, you find strong evidence that there is a rise of terrorism in places like Jordan, where yesterday there were shootouts in the streets of Amman outside of the royal palaces of the kingdom. And in Saudi Arabia, I just watched Saudi TV right now, and there were massive bombings affecting public security buildings in the capital, Riyadh. And if you read Arabic newspapers, every day or every other day, there is news of shootouts in the streets of Saudi Arabia and various places between the security forces and unidentified gunmen. And, of course, there is the story of Iraq, where if we are to believe the administration, they insist they are still making progress. We just don't seem to identify where progress is being made. And, of course, we have to go beyond that silly reference to a Sunni triangle. Today's explosion indicates that America's problem and terrorism and resistance and attacks and all sorts of reasons for violence in Iraq are spreading well beyond the Sunni triangle. And the administration talks about transfer of authority, and yet they cannot find an authority to transfer power to. And it's also important at this point, I just saw some glimpse of CNN, where they have one of those brilliant military analysts still insisting on blaming some outside forces, foreign conspiracies. One day it's Iran, another day it's Syria. And, of course, let's not forget that man with the wooden leg, who, if we are to believe the administration, Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi, is moving from one Middle East country to another, writing treaties and instigating violence. If it wasn't for him, all will be well in Iraq. That's the official version of the American story.
As the situation in Iraq grows ever more violent, the Bush administration is continuing to characterize the bloodshed as a minor hiccup on the path to a, quote, free and democratic Iraq. But according to a newly leaked coalition provisional authority memo written by a U.S. government official, the occupation of Iraq has created an environment rife with corruption and sectarianism, likely to result in civil war. The memo, obtained by independent reporter Jason Vest, details political corruption among American-appointed Iraqi politicians, the flow of Iranian money into the country, and the proliferation of militias and dependence of interim governing council members on them. We're joined on the phone right now by Jason Vest, a senior correspondent for the American Prospect, as well as a contributing editor to The Village Voice and In These Times. Vest has also been on the staff for The Washington Post, The Miami New Times, Boston Phoenix, and other publications. Can you talk about the latest information you have, Jason Vest? What does this memo say?
Well, I think you summed it up very nicely, Amy. One of the things that I think is particularly interesting about the memo is actually how much it validates some very prescient but also some very neglected pre-war work done by what I think some people have found surprising by the U.S. Army, and in particular the U.S. Army War College itself, playing off of some of what Assad was just saying. There are any number of people within the U.S. government, and within the U.S. military in particular, who made the very well-substantiated points that absent a really well-considered post-conflict stabilization program, you were likely to see Iraq begin a sort of a slow unraveling that would pick up speed sooner rather than later, revolving around issues of sectarianism and corruption. What's particularly interesting, too, I think very, very telling, this is that when you go back to over a year ago, you had so many key people within the administration asserting that really the opposite of what other people in government pointing out, that this was likely to be an enterprise fraught with peril. So the memo I obtained confirms, or seems to confirm and echo a lot of those assertions that were made well over a year ago.
Professor Assad Abu-Khalil, your response.
Well, I think that the Iraqi people did not need to read any memo to know the extent of corruption that is so rampant within the ranks of America's puppet council inside the country. It only undermines further their credibility. Look at the appointments to the key ministries, how they were made. Most of them are the son, the relative, the niece, the nephew of the major clients of the United States. Today they announced a formation of a new trial council for the trial of Saddam Hussein. And who did they find of all the qualified Iraqis to be in charge of that trial? None other than the nephew of that international embezzler known to Americans as Ahmad Shalabi, somebody who's also a business wheeler inside Iraq and who has absolutely no credibility inside the country. But perhaps he is the right choice. he will make sure to protect the American administration from any embarrassment. We can be sure that they will not be calling on Donald Rumsfeld to speak about his fond memories of his many meetings with Saddam Hussein back in the 1980s. And if you look at the appointments of the so-called new Minister of Defense, I mean, there was a fight for several months between Ahmad Chalabi and another member of that puppet council inside the country called Iyad Alawi. And those two, each was pushing for a relative between the two sides. So what did the administration, what Paul Bremer did finally do? He appointed a new Minister of Defense, and he found somebody who is from the Alawi family and yet was related by marriage to Ahmad Chalabi. These are the kind of appointments that are taking place in Iraq. That's why the Iraqi people are more insistent than ever on the right for free elections and democracy now, and they are not willing to wait. You know, you heard all the sorts of media in the United States talking about some public opinion surveys that seem on the surface to confirm what Americans wanted to believe. But they did not point out some of the more credible nationwide polls that were published in Iraqi newspapers. One of them indicated that 73% of all Iraqis, you can see a reference to that on my website, angryarab.blogspot.com, in which 73.1% of all Iraqis insist on having free election now, even if there is a delay to the so-called transfer of power, which most Iraqis don't take seriously. What kind of transfer of power is going to be when more than 130,000 troops will remain inside that country? We know, and they know, Iraq is still under domination of U.S. forces.
Jason Vest, among the things you report are that the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, is driving the black market in weapons.
Yes, that was one of the more interesting pieces of the memo. The memo in particular noted that the Iraqi police are selling their U.S. supplied weapons on the black market, and then they're promptly resupplied, and they continue the cycle. I had also heard similar things last year, both from some international aid folks and some U.S. military personnel as well. It was actually nice to have that noted in a CPA document finally. So yes, that was one of the more intriguing passages in the document.
Mm-hmm. Final comment, Saad Abu Khalil.
Well, I think that there should be now a debate about two things. One, what kind of Iraq the United States has been setting up, and I think it has become very obvious that they promised to make the Middle East, and they have done so. I mean, the Middle East is a very scary, fearful place. And I think Americans should be aware that this is the work of the Bush administration and their vision for a new Middle East. The second thing is, the question we should raise is, how this administration has certainly, by the admission of even their client dictators inside the Middle East, have made terrorism far more worse a threat today than it was 2 years ago. And I have been saying since September 11 that George W. Bush has become a much better recruiter for the cause of bin Laden than bin Laden himself. And Americans should be asking more questions about that.
On that note, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Saad Abu Khalil is a professor currently at the University of California, Berkeley, and Jason Vest has disclosed this memo from the CPA, a newly leaked Coalition Provisional Authority memo written by a U.S. government official. I want to thank you both for being with us. We'll go to an early break, and when we come back, we go to the landmark Guantanamo prison camp case before the Supreme Court. And finally, we'll hear from Pacifica Station KPFK programmer Jerry Quickly as we highlight community radio journalists around the country on our Exception to the Ruler's Tour. Again, tonight we hope to see lots of Los Angeles listeners and viewers at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church at 3300 Wilshire Boulevard at 7 p.m. celebrating Pacifica Station KPFK. Stay with us. hours in executing the so-called war on terror yesterday as it weighed whether the more than 600 foreigners held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have a right to plead their case before a judge. Yesterday's hearing, a majority of the justices sounded skeptical of the administration's claim that the president alone has control over the fate of the Guantanamo prisoners. It was the first of three cases to be heard this month that will test whether the president can label certain prisoners as, quote, unlawful enemy combatants and deny them all rights under the law. Next week, the court will consider whether the president can order the military to capture and hold without trial two U.S. citizens who he says are enemy combatants. One of them was captured in Afghanistan, the other arrested in Chicago. Yesterday's argument focused on foreigners who were picked up in Afghanistan or Pakistan in 2001 and shipped to the U.S. naval base in occupied Guantanamo, Cuba. They've been held in solitary confinement and questioned repeatedly. They have been denied the right to speak with their families or lawyers. They have not had a formal hearing at which they could challenge the basis for being held. The administration has maintained that these Guantanamo detainees do not deserve to be treated as prisoners of war under the Geneva Convention since they did not fight as soldiers in a conventional army. At the hearing, retired Judge John Gibbons argued on behalf of the Guantanamo detainees. U.S. Solicitor General Ted Olson defended the Bush administration. A decision is expected in late June. In a rare move, the Supreme Court released the audio recordings of yesterday's hearing. Here is how yesterday's session began.
We'll hear argument now, number 03334, Shafiq Rasool versus George W. Bush in a companion case. Mr. Gibbons.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. What's at stake in this case is the authority of the federal courts to uphold the rule of law. Respondents assert that their actions are absolutely immune from judicial examination whenever they elect to detain foreign nationals outside our borders. Under this theory, neither the length of the detention, the conditions of their confinement, nor the fact that they have been wrongfully detained makes the slightest difference. Respondents would create a lawless enclave, insulating the executive branch from any judicial scrutiny now or in the future.
That was Attorney John Gibbons arguing before the Supreme Court on Tuesday in the case of the Guantanamo Bay detainees. Arguing on behalf of the U.S. government, Solicitor General Ted Olson. This was his opening remarks.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the United States is at war. Over 10,000 American troops are in Afghanistan today in response to a virtually unanimous congressional declaration of an unusual and extraordinary threat to our national security and an authorization to the president to use all necessary and appropriate force to deter and prevent acts of terrorism against the United States. It is in that context that petitioners ask this court to assert jurisdiction that is not authorized by Congress, does not arise from the Constitution, has never been exercised by this court.
Mr. Olson, supposing the war had ended, could you continue to detain these people on Guantanamo, and would there then be jurisdiction?
We believe that there would not be jurisdiction.
The existence of the war is really irrelevant to the legal issue.
It is not irrelevant because it is in this context that that question is raised. And the case of Johnson versus Eisentrager, which we have discussed here, even the dissent in that case said that it would be fantastic to assume that habeas corpus jurisdiction would exist in the time of war. So that case is not...
Your position does not depend on the existence of a war.
It doesn't depend upon that, Justice Stevens, but it's even more forceful.
U.S. Solicitor General Ted Olson before the Supreme Court being questioned by Justice John Paul Stevens. Much of the discussion centered on whether the U.S. courts had jurisdiction over detainees held at Guantanamo, the U.S. naval base located in Cuba. Here's what Attorney John Gibbons had to say.
Guantanamo is, to some extent, unique. One of the amicus briefs that surveyed the United States Navy bases elsewhere, points out that this is the only base, for example, where the United States has not entered into a status of forces agreement. It's not at all clear that we have exclusive jurisdiction, civil jurisdiction, in any of our other enclaves in foreign countries. But we have exclusive jurisdiction and control over civil law in Guantanamo, and have had for a century. So it's totally artificial to say that because of this provision in the lease, the executive branch can create a no-law zone where it is not accountable to any judiciary anywhere. Now, in some other places where the United States has a base, there may be other civil authority that can demand an accounting. But what the executive branch is saying here is we don't have to account to anyone anywhere.
Attorney John Gibbons before the Supreme Court. Later during the hour argument, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer took issue with the government's claim that the executive body could detain individuals with no judicial oversight.
I'm still honestly most worried about the fact that there would be a large category of unchecked and uncheckable actions dealing with the detention of individuals that are being held in a place where America has power to do everything. Now, that's what's worrying because of Article 3. And the other thing on the opposite side, as I said, is it's possible to tailor the substance to take care of the problems that are worrying you. Those are my two basic points.
Well, let me get back to it again. Those earlier cases were decided and rejected in Eisentrager case. Whether there's a check on the executive, there's a congressional check, through the power of legislation, through the power of oversight, through the power of appropriations.
Can we hold hearings to determine the problems that are bothering you? I mean, we have to take your word for what the problems are. We can't call witnesses and see what the real problems are, can we, in creating this new substantive rule that we're going to let the courts create? Congress could do all that, though, couldn't it?
Congress could do all that.
If it wanted to change the habeas statute, it could make all sorts of refined modifications.
Yes, it could.
About issues that we know nothing whatever about, because we have only lawyers before us, we have no witnesses, we have no cross-examination, we have no investigative staff, and we should be the ones, Justice Breyer suggests, to draw up this reticulated system to preserve our military from intervention by the courts.
Well, we would agree with that, and we would emphasize the point that the stepping across that line would be impossible to go back from with respect to prisoners in the battlefield. In fact, the reply brief refers to the front lines in Iraq, at a battle station in Iraq. We're talking here about battlefield decisions.
All I mean by working out the substantive rights is what Justice Harlan meant and what Justice Kennedy meant in adopting Justice Harlan's view in Verdugo. And that really derives from the Insular cases, and I don't think it's something that requires witnesses and reticulated, whatever they are, tax codes.
Well, to the extent that the court would say, the executive, you must give a military process, because the petitioners in this case, first of all, demanded in their petition, and they would have a right to raise these issues to the extent they haven't backed off in this case, but they demanded in their petition the release, unmonitored communications with counsel, cessation of interrogations, evidentiary...
Our doctrine would have to be applied in the first instance by 800 different district judges, I take it.
There was no question that is exactly right, and to the extent that what the petitioners are seeking is to oversee the this is the language in their brief, to oversee the circumstances of detention, that is going to be vary from case to case.
General Olson, I've looked at the reply brief, which is their last chance to say what they mean, and they say we're not asking for any of those things, certainly not asking to have a lawyer there while these people are being interrogated. They are saying, look, we are claiming that our people are innocents, and for purposes of this proceeding, we must assume that. And all we want is some process to determine whether they are indeed innocent.
That was Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Before that, Antonin Scalia questioning Solicitor General Theodore Olson during the opening argument of the case on the Guantanamo-based detainees. We're joined now by Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, in the courtroom yesterday at the Supreme Court. Can you describe the scene, Michael, very briefly, and the significance of the kind of questioning that went on?
Well, for me, it was extraordinary. You know, we started these cases at the center 2.5 years ago, and to finally get into the Supreme Court and that to finally see a majority of the court really sharply questioning the government was very moving to all of us. We were very optimistic about it. They gave Solicitor General Olson, I think, a very hard time on some of the issues that you just spoke about, on whether the war makes any difference, particularly on a case that the solicitor relied on, a case called Eisentrager from the Second World War, which they argue says that aliens outside the United States have no rights. And the court said, look, that's 60 years ago. It's a different case. Those people were convicted by a military tribunal. That's not this case. The four liberal judges were very much on our side. And the two swing judges, which would be O'Connor and Kennedy, asked very sharp questions of Olson, questioning Eisentrager, questioning particularly interestingly, the government took the position that citizens on Guantanamo would have a right to come into an American court. And they said, why should citizens have that right and not non-citizens? Because the statute, the habeas statute, says anyone imprisoned can open the courthouse door. And they said, why should there be a difference in that? And really, the solicitor couldn't come up with a reason for that. I think what you played by Justice Breyer was the crucial part. He said, look, the courthouse door just shouldn't be closed. It's one thing to say it shouldn't be closed, and it's another thing what rights people may have, but we just can't close the door of the courthouse. And I think that's what this case is about. Can you close the door of the courthouse to an entire group of non-citizens being held by the United States?
Michael Ratner, I want to thank you very much for being with us, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, as we'll continue to follow these historic cases before the Supreme Court. In Congress, senior Bush administration officials came under harsh questioning at a hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee, hearing among a host of question-answer face-offs Congress scheduled with administration officials amid increased anxiety on Capitol Hill over what's happening in Iraq. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, one of the key architects of the invasion of Iraq, began with a half-hour statement focusing mostly on administration claims that the abuses of Iraqis under Saddam's rule. He came under questioning by Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy.
Mr. Secretary, I must say I found your presentation here this morning somewhat disingenuous. I was here when the administration made the case for going to war, and the case for going to war was the threat that the United States was facing from nuclear weapons that were going to be provided to Al-Qaeda by Iraq. And here we have your statements all about the human rights violations. Everyone knows that Saddam Hussein is a brute, despicable, deplorable murderer. And I'll include in the record the State Department's filing about the human rights violations around the world, about what the Chinese are doing to the Tibetans, what the North Koreans are doing in terms of torture, forced abortions, infanticide, what the Burmese are doing, and the rest of the world. And I want to make that as a part of the record. There wasn't a word in this presentation about the weapons of mass destruction in this presentation here this morning. Now, Mr. Secretary, you were one of the principal architects of war with Iraq, and it's been on your agenda since the end of the Gulf War, 1991. It's now clear the Iraq was high on the agenda of the administration from day one, even though the outgoing Clinton administration made it clear in the briefings during the transition that Al-Qaeda was the most serious threat to our security. Dick Clark, the former counterterrorism czar, wrote that when he raised Al-Qaeda in the first meeting of the deputies in April 2001, you, Mr. Secretary, said, I just don't understand why we are beginning by talking about this one man, bin Laden. At every stage, even after 9/11, it seems that you treated al-Qaeda as less than a main threat, as a diversion from the real priority, which was Iraq. And in his book, Bob Woodward says the administration diverted resources from the war in Afghanistan to plan for the war in Iraq.
That is Senator Ted Kennedy speaking yesterday at a hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee. This is Democracy Now! As we turn to alternative coverage of what's happening in the war, Jerry Quickly has been with us in our New York studio when he returned from Iraq, escaping the bombing there. He is one of the programmers on Pacifica station KPFK, and he joins us in our studio today here in Los Angeles as we continue with our Exception to the Rulers tour. I think it's fair to call Jerry Quickly one of the exception to the rulers. Welcome, Jerry.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks so much for having me.
It's good to have you with us. The coverage today of Iraq, what you think needs to be told and who needs to be telling these stories?
I think the stories need to be told primarily by the Iraqi people so you can kind of hear what's going on. You don't just have policy wonks, you know, and talking heads coming on. And the coverage has been woefully inadequate, particularly in American news media. You go, you travel abroad and there's, it's like the coverage from other countries. You wonder, are they covering actually the same conflict that we see here in America?
What are you doing now as you organize with other alternative reporters and coverage of Iraq?
Right now, I'm raising funds to go back to Iraq to do further coverage and also to get some more footage for my documentary called B-Boy in Baghdad, which is a coverage of the Iraqi conflict really from the hip-hop perspective.
And what would be different about the hip-hop perspective?
I think what would primarily be different is that it's kind of a coverage from the ground up and really talking to the Iraqi people. And when I would go and talk to people in Baghdad about it, I would and other cities, I would literally, if there was a kid in the street selling gasoline, that's the kid I wanted to talk to. If there's some guy selling cigarettes who looked like he was broke and down to his last dollar, that's the person I wanted to talk to. And those are the people that I interviewed. And you get a very, very different take on from talking to those people than you do wealthy students at universities or U.S. soldiers or policy wonks.
B-Boy in Baghdad, where'd you get the title?
Well, you know, B-Boys, you know, anyone who's a devotee or, you know, habitué of hip-hop culture and, you know, and I just like certainly the wordplay, how it sounded, just B-Boy in Baghdad. It seemed like a natural fit for the perspective of the film and what I hope to cover in the documentary.
Well, I look forward to seeing you tonight. Jerry Quickly is going to be reading some of his work at tonight's Celebration of Independent Media, KPFK. Tonight, as we continue with the Exception to the Rulers tour, we'll all be at the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church at 3300 Wilshire Boulevard in Los Angeles. Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you so much, Jerry. Thanks for having me.
And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by a bi-coastal team here in Los Angeles. Sharif Abdelkaddous, Jeremy Scahill, John Hamilton in New York, Mike Burke, Elizabeth Press, Uri Galed, the whole team. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.